to Madame Perry Salon.
Love Talk Radio.
Oh, there's that woman again. Somebody asked me last week. That might have been Doug Bremner or somebody. Said, "Where did the British woman come in?" I don't know. She came with the studio. You know, just part of the. It's just one of the assets. Anyway, welcome. I'm Jennifer Perry, welcoming you to Madame Perry Salon. And some of you may know that this started. Is that a critic, Cheryl?
Could be. It's not my dog.
Oh, okay. Maybe it's Arch Jack Russell. So, yeah. Madame Perry Salon began about 5 or 6 years ago as a blog. And because I'm such a throwback to olden situations, old times, I wanted something more of a cultural salon like they used to have in Europe, England, and so forth, where there would be a patroness who brought in artists and musicians and the great thinking minds of the time to have discussions and just enjoy each other and have share work that they were doing. And I started as a blog. I would usually have two people interview a guest. And now I get to bring it live to the people so the discussion can be even more not so structured with the question and answer. It can be a little bit more lively and more sometimes uninhibited. If I can't think of a better word, Arch, you're pretty educated. Help me where I need a thesaurus, please. And we get to have some nice callers, too, some very lively callers. So I'm going to play the intro music, which is Miss E's Vacation by Denton Perry. Welcome to Madame Perry Salon. Okay, about this man. He is a 2-time Emmy winner. He's been nominated for a Pulitzer Prize, I believe. Frequent guest on all the major shows, Nancy Grace, Jane Velez Mitchell. He's had stories featured on Good Morning America, CBS Early, Fox, Geraldo Rivera, former Atlanta Bureau Chief for the Washington Post, and nominated by the Washington Post Style section for a Pulitzer Prize in feature writing. This man, I could spend the show going ahead and discussing what this man does and who he is. He develops reality shows, documentaries, co-written a pilot on missing kids for Original Productions called Vanish, and that's not all. He also owns Busy Street Productions, which makes films as well. And let me introduce my dear pal. I'm such a fan, Art Harris. Art, welcome to Madame Perry Salon.
I'm flattered and honored to be among you all.
I'm flattered and honored to have you here. And by the way, let me say you look good tonight. All the guests are dressed so well tonight. Something about Armani just always suits you, Harris. I think it was just made for you.
Well, I'm glad that I don't have my Skype camera on right now. That is the beauty of being able to blog from your man cave.
Listen, Art, don't ruin the illusion for the audience, because I have had shows where I've said, let's all pretend like we're in a pajama party, and everybody would say what kind of pajamas they had on. So, you know show business. You got to create the illusion now for your people.
Well, just imagine the suits I usually wear on TV, and you'll be fine.
Okay. You always look great. And this lady, the next lady, she is a Canadian living in Mexico. I don't ask her about her past, and she doesn't ask about mine, so I don't know why. She's been a secretary, property manager, a drug prosecutor, a corporate lawyer, and recently a keyboard player with the Cuban Salsa Band in Cancun, and a publisher, editor, and now she has her first novel, Cheryl, or we call her S.J. Dunn. Cheryl, welcome
Thank
to the
you.
Show.
Oh, thanks so much. I'm really, really delighted to be with such illustrious guests and the illustrious host.
Oh, thank you, dear. Thank you so much. Glad somebody. Yeah. So, And you look lovely tonight too, Cheryl. By the
oh,
way.
Oh, thank you, thank you. I'm wearing Vendi, I think.
Oh,
I'm
really?
Not sure what I'm wearing. Yes, yes.
Lovely, lovely. Okay. Yeah, I asked my husband for some designer. He said, yeah, I think you got me some Jaclyn Smith at Kmart. So, but you know, he's a good man, so you just keep on going. All right, my next guest has a, well, she's a journalist and an author. She writes for The Economist, Christian Science Monitor, The Daily Beast, HuffPo. She has a blog called The Broadside. She has three books. One is Sex in the South, Unbuckling the Bible Belt. And then she had a cocktail recipe book. I just learned this while Cheryl and I were talking with her earlier. And also her newest is a novel, Echo Ellis, Adventures of a Girl Reporter. Let's introduce Susie Parker. Welcome, Susie.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, delighted to have you here. Art Harris, what are you doing these days, Art? I know you're at Oglethorpe University as well, but what do you have new coming up? What's going on? Art.
Did we lose him? We may have lost him. Technical problems. Hello?
I think he may have vanished.
Yeah, he vanished like his program. He's a missing child. The protagonist of my next novel, she lost her son when he was 8 years old, and she's now 67, and she's never found him. So missing children as well as abused children are a soft spot, or I guess you could call it a hot button for me.
For you.
Yeah, and I think it is for all of us, wouldn't you say, given the things that you've covered, Susie?
I would. I would definitely say that is a hot-button issue.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I think it is, obviously, for Art. I wonder what happened.
Yeah, this is such a topic that's been on my radar for quite a while, including dealing with the people who were supposed to track down these very elusive and deceitful pedophiles. They're, as you know, they're like a swarm, and there's a beehive underground where they hide and help each other. And the FBI developed, I don't know if you've heard of the Innocent Images Project, where they were using the young high school girls to teach agents how to email and chat online and sound like they were minors. That's what it takes to lure these guys into revealing themselves. They are they're predators. They prey on people who are in the middle of crises. Often, for example, Michael Jackson, all of his victims were from broken homes. Some of the characters I have written about the pedophiles. One of the karate teacher in Baton Rouge. Moved in on a family that was divorced, and the son was looking for a father figure. So, they have an M.O., and I don't believe, at least the psychologists I've talked to, that they can be cured. So as a result, you've got to figure out how do you survive and protect.
Cheryl.
Hello.
It's Cheryl. I'm back on.
It's Susie. I'm back on as well.
Yeah. Did they cut you off?
Yes.
Yeah. Very strange.
All of a sudden, I was like, oh, I guess it's over.
Yeah. that was
short
but sweet. Short but sweet. Well, it's
off.
Interesting. Oh, Art,
sorry.
Are you there?
I keep getting cut off by the technology.
Yeah.
Calling from a new phone. A new phone, anyway.
It's interesting, Art, that you should touch on the issue of the dark net and where pedophiles hang out and the way they groom children on internet chat rooms and so on, because the protagonist in my next novel, my work in progress called A Million Closed Eyes, that's what she volunteers for, a similar organization.
Ah, okay, great.
Yeah,
it opens
with a case where she's turning up to give evidence against one of these pedophiles. And the other interesting thing is that, given that you talked about this fellow in Baton Rouge who groomed a young family, well, she was groomed, her children were groomed, and she was groomed after she lost her first husband. So the backstory of my characters is very much based in real life.
Well, that's the best fiction comes from real life. And did you hear me when I said how much I loved your opening and your current novel? I just
oh, thank you. No, I didn't hear that. Oh, I'm
this
delighted.
Is this is the one where I don't want to say what the pedophile does to himself, but the woman in the woods is that's
yes.
yours, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
And the way she bumbles and fumbles as a an avenger. Is so real, and I just, you know, knowing crime scenes and how people go about them, to have a criminal who's not perfect, you know,
which
is very credible.
Know.
Anyway, but I couldn't put it down. So thank you, great stuff.
Oh, thank you.
But getting back to your point about real life, I want to tell you about this guy in Baton Rouge named Gary Plochet, good old boy, salesman, well-loved by everybody. He's separated from his wife, which opens up an opportunity for this pedophile. Nobody knows that the karate teacher who has all the boys in the community, including his son Jody at the time, was 12. He's now a man, grown man, was a great-looking kid, great athlete. And Jeffrey Doucette was an ex-Marine. Who would have dreamed that this would be part of his, his dark side? So he takes these kids on trips and, singles Jody out and winds up doing fun things with him as well to groom him, so that when it gets to the other sexual stuff, he's not as resistant as some might be. And that's what they do as well. You know, candy little girl has more to it than just that phrase. But he then gets close to the mother and begins dating her so he can stay close to Jody. Only he's not a typical boyfriend. And when I wrote the story for the Washington Post, I said they were romantically involved. The lawyer for the Post came down in deadline. How can you say that? You know, we might get sued. I said, well, would you rather use the phrase "the detective told me four times doggy style," and that was his, he was a misfit. Anyway, so he takes his kid, and the mother finally gets on to him. So he kidnaps him and takes him to California on a bus. Dyes his hair black, takes him to Disney World. The father, the family goes crazy, gets in touch with the sheriff's department deputy. The mother used to date, and the FBI finally finds him, and they go out and they save the kid and they bring him back, and the father is so outraged that he begins hanging out at the local bar, the Cotton Club, where his former associates at the TV station work, and he finds out when the plane is coming in from L.A., and he waits at the Baton Rouge airport with a hat pulled down over his eyes, his .38 loaded with two different caliber bullets, and when the deputy walks by with Jeffrey Doucette handcuffed to him, he wheels around, and you can hear the deputy say, "No, Gary, no," bam, bam, two shots to the head. He bleeds out right there on the floor of the airport. And an ABC cameraman captured the whole thing. I go down there to interview the family. Gary gets 2 months in prison. I mean 2 months in a psychiatric hospital, and everyone, he's a community hero because he's done what a lot of family members would do if that happened to their child. So here I am with him years later. I said, "Gary, is there anything that you would do differently now?" He says, "I wish I could dig him up and shoot him again."
Yeah.
And that is those are the kind of, just extreme hate hateful, you know, just vengeful feelings that this conjures. And who's to say that any of us might snap if that were to happen to us? So it's a really hot topic, and people handle it differently. And just it's so sad that the kids who are become victims, there's so many of them we don't know about.
Yes, exactly. Because people close their eyes, and the kids don't tell. And it's really a shame. And the other thing that I find objectionable about the way the media covers the situation is that they don't define or distinguish between pedophiles and other nasty people. And when I say other nasty people, I mean, say, the female teacher who has an affair with a 15-year-old male student. They call her a pedophile, and she's not. She's done something, you know, where it's been an abuse of power, but she's not a pedophile. Sandusky is not a pedophile either. Pedophiles go after prepubescent kids.
Yeah.
So when we throw all these kinds of disorders and bad activities into the same pot, I don't think that helps us solve the problem, because the first step in solving a problem is obviously defining it.
Well, you know, just what you said about Michael Jackson would lose interest in his victims, and I'm totally convinced that he was a pedophile, because when they reach puberty, and so that would categorize him, you know, he would fit the definition you're citing.
Yes.
And that's
yes.
a fascinating story I can talk about. But the jury came back, even though he was acquitted, there were two jurors who felt that he was guilty, and the prosecution just didn't prove it. So this is, and I interviewed the sex crimes detective years ago who investigated him in the first case of, everyone knows the guy's kid's name, Jordy Chandler, and he quietly paid them off, paid $20 million for them to go away. And he had his house, I was there, rigged up with a warning system where if anybody came to his hall, it set up an alarm. And he had triple locked doors, and you know he knew he was doing something wrong. And this whole Peter Pan concocted fantasy of him as a grown man with the heart of a child was such an illusion. I mean, I heard him outside the courthouse when I was covering the trial, and he came one day in pajamas. You know, Gloria Allred was his nemesis. She was trying to take his children away through defects. So here he is. He's coming out of the trial, and she's outside, and the bodyguard comes up to him and says, Michael, you don't want to go over there. It was Gloria Allred. And he says, Gloria Allred can go to hell. It's not the, hey, I'm little Peter Pan. Let's go read a little story. He dropped about six octaves. Now, that was, to me, he doesn't ever let down his guard like that. So those kinds of things are tip-offs, but they are deceivers, and very difficult to spot, and like, you know, say Sandusky and others, who maybe not a technical pedophile, he was around a lot of boys,
exactly.
Because he was in sports, and some of them run camps, and the Boy Scouts, who I investigated, was just rife with pedophiles, and may still be, but you know they claim they're doing what they can, but they covered up some of their counselors.
That's the shame of the whole thing, the way society treats its children and covers up these things. It's hard enough for the child to come forward, and then when the organization or individual or family or whatever covers it up, I doubt that the child ever recovers fully. The children who have been abused like that, I think they receive a life sentence, even if they do get proper counseling.
I have to say Jody Ploche is one of the lucky ones, because even though he did have this, was a victim of his karate teacher, today he has grown up to be a job holding, dating, great guy who actually worked against sexual violence and counseled people and with a project called Men Against Rape. So Jody is down in Baton Rouge doing really, really great work using his you know, his experience to try to help others. In much the same way, you know, Nancy Grace was a crime victim when her fiancé was murdered in mm-hmm. college, and that led her to funnel her grief and anger into her career. So, you know, I think it's possible, but it's you got to have a really supportive family. And the sheriff in Baton Rouge, who was close to the family, told him when he brought the kid back from California, now, you got to give him a total accepting atmosphere. You can't act at all disapproving of anything he says. He's got to talk mm-hmm. about what happened to him, or it will set him back. So provide
good.
Him that. And they had to bite their tongue. And anyway, so I'm sure that you've come across that kind of research in the people you've counseled
yes.
as well.
I think we have somebody on the line here that's in Baton Rouge right now, don't we?
Yes. Hi.
Hi. Is this Carrie Dunn in Baton Rouge?
Yep.
Author Carrie Dunn in Baton Rouge. Carrie, glad to have you here. Say hello to Art Harris, and you know Cheryl Dunn and Susie Parker.
Hi. How are y'all?
Hey. How
hello.
Are you?
Hi, Carrie.
You're down in the bayou.
I was listening. Yeah, down in the bayou. I was just listening in. Very interesting conversation.
Do you know Jody by chance?
I do not. I was living in Austin at the time all that went on, when his father, you know, was at the airport. But I know my family and friends here when it happened, just, you know, good. That was kind of their reaction.
Oh, yeah. He's a local legend, and it's just the culture of different societies. You know, I've covered other other revenge killers who weren't as lucky, including mm-hmm. a guy in South Carolina who had the killer of his parents killed in prison and then had to face going to jail himself and did 3 years.
Killed in prison, Art. Now, how does that happen? I mean,
did
you work that?
Fascinating story. Here's a guy who has been a working man in construction all his life. His parents run a little mom-and-pop grocery store. Two guys come down from New York with shotguns and go in, hold them up, and then shoot them. They're caught. The evidence is right there in the car. They're convicted in a trial and sentenced to life. So suddenly, one of them wins a new trial based on a technicality called bifurcated sentencing. You can't sentence someone at the same proceeding where they were found guilty. So suddenly this guy's getting a new trial. Tony Simo cannot handle that. He believed in the system. Suddenly the system lets him down. He starts cruising the bars in Myrtle Beach trying to find someone in the biker bars who might know someone in prison to get rid of this guy who's killed his parents. He finds somebody who says, okay, I'll put you in touch. He then gets into a conversation with a guy named Pee-wee Gaskins, a rat-faced little runt who's about 5'2", who's also drowned a mother and her child, and happens to be living after killing 9 people because of the technicality, and he's now a trustee. So he's the guy who buys the food and the sandwiches, and so he says, yeah, I'll do it for $500, but I need some poison. Go get me some poison. So Tony starts reading up on poison. He doesn't know anything about poison, and he finds the oleander bush is poisonous. It's in his backyard. He goes and he cuts down a bunch. He boils it up, gets it into a residue, and smuggles it into the jail in the heel of the boot. He gives it to the guy, and this peewee sprinkles it on a sandwich he then hands to Ronald Tyner and watches him eat it. Tick tock, tick tock. What's going to happen? Well, he says, "Uh-oh! All it did was make him a little peaked. It didn't do anything much. So Tony, this time I want you to send me some dynamite." Well, he knows the plaster. So Tony now has a mission. He's got to find some C4. He's on the construction site, so he has access to it, and he somehow gets some C4 into the prison. Pee-wee then fashions like you would think, a walkie-talkie-looking sort of device, and he puts a heating coil in it with some C4, and he sends it across the way and says to Tyner, "Hey, yes, listen, man, we can talk to each other if you just plug this into the wall." Well, he plugs in the wall, and boom, there goes the killer. So he reels the cord back to his cell, and there's, you know, virtually no evidence. Maybe a little plastic, but, you know. So he all his mum until Pee-wee's the guy's homosexual lover rats him out. And suddenly the feds are all over it. They track the prison payphone. You know, those touch tone bleeps that happen on a payphone, you can track that to somebody's phone. They go to Tony's friend's house. He fingers Tony. Tony then has to face, okay, will he take a plea, 2 years, 8 years to serve two, and he does. And, you know, a couple of years later, I meet him. The first day he's out of prison, we go and drinking beer on the river there, and I did a story for the Post and for People magazine. And it's just an amazing story. In fact, I turned that one into a movie for CBS called Vengeance, the tragedy of Tony Simo.
Oh, so, wonderful.
Anyway, but you see, with him, it was different than Gary because there was a tough prosecutor who was not going to sanction vigilante justice, because then, you know, every good old boy would be offing someone who had done his family wrong.
You think I don't know, I'm just spitballing here, but maybe something to do with using a third party to seek the vengeance as opposed to doing it yourself? I mean, with that lesson, some kind of diminished capacity defense or something, something premeditated?
That's a great point. You know, if he doesn't have access to him, he didn't really have a choice unless he then, you know, did something to get into prison. But sure, I mean, that it was more third party and more like a kind of a mafia type hit arrangement. I mean, I know the prosecutor well. He's a great guy. Dick Harpootlian was a state attorney general in South Carolina, is now head of the Democratic Party, and he's an amazing guy, and he just had to enforce the law. And his I think he was actually concerned that if it had gone to trial, he would lose because of community sentiment. But the wife didn't want to risk that he would get longer in prison. So that's what happened there.
Well, do you think vigilantism is growing? I mean, I think, for example, 15 years ago, when there was a high profile murder in a community, you wouldn't hear the police saying things like "Don't take the law into your own hands," and now it seems that police are constantly saying that in the cases of many murders. And I'm not sure. I mean, I've wanted to kill. I never have so far. So be nice to me.
Okay.
But I think there is this growing feeling that the justice system is not protecting us, neither adults nor children, and so people are considering vigilantism more frequently than they used to. And I think,
ladies and gentlemen, I'm sorry I have to go, but I just want to say this has been a very interesting conversation. Thank y'all so much.
Hey, Carrie.
Oh, thanks,
I just wanted
Carrie.
To check in.
Thank you so
thanks
much, Carrie. Thanks
for
being here.
Thanks. It's been
all
very
right.
interesting.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. And before we go any further, let's see, Susie Parker, you're still here?
I'm here.
Okay, good. So I've got to get to you in a minute. And also,
I'm enchanted by these stories.
Aren't you?
I am.
Are we the luckiest gals or what to be in this? So also I have another caller on the line, and I think this is supposed to be a surprise might be a surprise to you, Art. Hi, this is Madam Perry. Who am I speaking, please?
Oh, this is Doug.
Hey, Doug.
Doug Bremner.
Would that be Doug Bremner?
Yeah, that would be Doug Bremner, yeah.
The Doug Bremner.
Doug.
Hey, Doug. I love your sister, Doug. Huh? Doug, are you there?
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yeah, I sure can. Yeah, I love your sister, Ann. We've been covered a lot of stories together. Will you give her my best?
Oh, yeah, sure, absolutely. Thanks.
That's great.
Hey,
you're
Doug.
Go ahead.
Oh, thank you so much for calling, Doug, and I am just delighted to have you here tonight. And I was talking to Art earlier today, and I was telling him about talking about your films and your work, but I told him about your newest book, whom Cheryl Dunn here, her company Shelf Signals, published, called You Can't Just Snap Out of It, and it's about PTSD.
Yeah, that's
and,
right.
Actually, if I can correct that. Shelf Stealers was going to publish it, but then didn't. And so Laughing Cow Productions published it. Isn't that right, Doug?
Yeah, but you guys did most of the work. It's just that Cheryl was having some problems with her eyes, so we put it out ourselves. But it's been kind of a and Cheryl helped a lot, and the editors and stuff. But it's supposed to be it was designed as a guide for people to be able to read on their own and kind of chart their own course through recovery from psychological trauma. It has an easy to remember acronym called START NOW that, you know, S is for seeking safety and support, and T is for talking about your trauma. And so it's kind of more concrete. And, you know, I've written other books that are more academic about trauma, but I wanted to have a real simple guide for people that, you know, that to really helps the people that are actually suffering from it.
Well, I'd love to talk to you off the air sometime. You know, I was embedded with the 2nd Marines in Iraq in 2003 in a place called Nasiriyah, where they lost, 19 men in a friendly fire incident. And it was really pretty gruesome. And when they came back, some of these young guys, you know, they're not much older than my sons, who were at the time, and they were teenagers. They would walk into a 7-Eleven, and this one guy's wife told me he would just explode if the clerk was Middle Eastern. He would get so angry he wanted to kill the guy. And he said, "Will you talk to him?" Or I pulled him aside. I said, "Look, you know, there's nothing at all unmanly or unmarine like than going and asking for help. You know, they got people at Camp Lejeune, and this is something that, you know, that you don't want to drag you into a situation you can't get out of, and you really owe it to your family, your wife, and your child, and yourself. You need, you can get some peace if you will go talk about it and help yourself." So, you know, he actually did, and later his wife told me that he was much better. And you work at the VA, Doug, or you did? I think it has an excellent trauma recovery program.
Yeah, I'm a part-time physician at the VA here in Atlanta, and then we also did this program in conjunction with the Cowley Gardens, which is a large kind of vacation place in Georgia. But the Bo Cowley, who passed away last year, was the Secretary of the Army way back when, senator,
sure.
And he so together with them, and then with the Fort Benning, we created this program for military families where soldiers coming back from Iraq or Afghanistan within the past year, that him and his wife and kids would go to Cowley Gardens for 10 days, and we had this series of lectures and kind of educational things and then activities for them to promote family bonding. And we called it the Cowley Homecoming Initiative. And one of the wives said that they were planning on getting divorced, but then after that program, they changed their mind, decided not to get divorced, which is really good.
That's fantastic.
So we did three of these pilot programs, kind of hoping that someone would come along and, you know, donate a bunch of money for it, but that didn't happen. But so we felt like, well, we have this great program, and, you know, don't let it go to waste. So that's sort of where a lot of that material for the book came from, was from what we'd learned actually doing these pilot programs. And so we're going to start again doing some kind of similar seminars in Atlanta. Not really, to be honest, it's really hard, harder than I thought to get trauma survivors to, you know, sign up for seminars and stuff like that. Although I guess I shouldn't be surprised.
Well, we've been so isolated and just marinating in their rage, anger, and frustration that I can understand that.
The military, we kind of, they got paid leave, and it's kind of like the military said, this is a good thing for you to do, and it was like 10 days. You know, they stayed in these little cabins at Cowley Gardens, and they had zip lines and nature tours and butterfly gardens, all kinds of stuff like that. But what we're kind of moving towards now is maybe using this as a training to train people how to work with trauma survivors, like social workers and stuff like that.
That's great. And de-stress, are you working with any of the other VA programs that offer these veterans like a week away with Outward Bound or sailing? I mean, just on a ranch, a dude ranch to ride, just to change the whole circumstance and psyche that they've come back with?
Well, like there's, you know, I had contacted like this Wounded Warriors program, which I hadn't heard back from them, but there's some foundations that are not necessarily part of the VA that you know, offer treatment, and there's all different kinds of things going on. You know, I'm not really sure. Not all of them are actually the VA. Some are nonprofits that are focused on the military. There's like something like 3,000 nonprofit foundations in the U.S. that are focused on the military.
Right. Well, this is actually
your book is so great for it, Doug. Dr. Brammer's book, You Can't Just Snap Out of It, deals with all kinds of trauma, but also has special chapters for not only the veteran, but also the families of veterans. And are you planning on using the Start Now program and training people on how to guide people through that, Doug?
Yeah, like we had like a, you know, we had a couple chapters. It's like, or, you know, within the original program, there were, we had like a lecture just for the spouses. So the topic was military families, spouses. And we had military families, children. Then military families focus on the soldier. And so for the spouses, we only had the spouses come to the lecture. And we would talk about, like, what is it like to be a military spouse? What are the five phases of deployment? You know, the heading up to deployment, the actual deployment, the intermediate period, the return home, and each phase has a different kind of psychological profile for the family, and a lot of it is stuff that, you know, people don't talk about. So what we found is that when we get these spouses together, one of them say, oh, well, I thought such and such, and then someone else say, oh, I thought that too, but I was kind of ashamed to admit it, you know, and, you know, stuff like feeling, you know, that it's hard when the soldier comes back, and you know, you have all these stereotypes about how it should be and things don't always work out that way. But so we would do these lectures, and I would just sort of like let them start talking, you know, for an hour or so amongst themselves. And, you know, that was a really good experience because they didn't have any other forums other than these programs that were organized by the military. And I can't remember what they're called, but they were sort of like for support of the families when people are deployed. But a lot of them said that they became kind of like gossip, you know, things, and you know, there's a lot of negativity that could develop because, you know, there's things like, you know, infidelity, and it became like kind of a rumor mill situation.
Yeah. There's a lot of them are at risk for, you know, for other, you know, other inhumanities like that. I mean, in the desert, I had to. I mean, there were a number of young guys who got Dear John letters, you know, in the desert. I mean, imagine that. That's and they were lined up to use my satellite phone because, you know, I would let them, and their commander, at least their captain, wouldn't. So the line would stretch, you know, way down the road to use the phone. And one kid said, "So you can get on the desert? You can get on your laptop, Miss Harris? Can you? Do you think you could write my girlfriend and tell her I'm okay? And what else do you want to tell her? So what's her name? Judy? Okay. Well, what do you want to tell her? Do you want to tell her that? Just tell her I'm fine. I miss her. Don't you want to tell her you miss her beautiful blue eyes and soft white skin, soft shape of her neck, and yes, sir, write that, you know." So, so we, you know, you became really close to these guys, and you know what they're going through is, I mean, they're young, and suddenly they're faced with life and death situations. Their friends are being killed. They're on edge because they're going, you know, door to door, house to house. They don't know what's behind the next door, and you know, I'm kind of following with a camera, and they are you know, everybody's on edge. So, you know, you're under fire, and you don't know where it's coming from at night. And I've got a tape that I played at the Army War College. You can hear my driver yelling at the machine gunner who drops down in the middle of the firefight onto my lap from the the top of the truck, and the driver yells back, "Get back on machine gun! You keep shooting, we're all gonna effing die!" And so he scrambles back up there, and you know, so after all that, you know, you got to have a way to de-stress, and it's going to come out in ways that you hadn't planned. Whether, you know, you don't talk about it, it's going to sink into your deep into your cells and become anger, depression, and everything else that that happens. So, you know, I applaud you, Doug, for everything you're doing, and like I said, I'd love to talk to you off camera sometime.
Yeah, I'll. Well, you can get it from Ann, but I can also share your information with each other too after the show.
Great, great.
Guys.
Great.
Yeah.
Well,
but I think, have you ever seen any? And I'm curious, Doug. I mean, do you think trauma survivors and PTSD guys, are they at risk, more at risk for violence and you know, killing people than the average person out there in terms of even revenge killings? Are they? I think they would be more prone to act on that kind of a, you know, a rage and love motive if their child or somebody was harmed.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the anger is, you know, a symptom of PTSD, and you know, so they definitely we definitely see, you know, even like back from the Vietnam War, like the Vietnam veterans going to the Vietnamese restaurant would have these kind of rage reactions about being Vietnamese, and now it's the same with people, seeing people from the Middle East, and you know, so they not only have the anger and kind of impulse control, but sometimes this can also actually go into flashbacks where they feel like that the, you know, the person is an actual insurgent or an enemy combatant, and they that's a situation where they've lost control with reality, basically. It's kind of like psychosis almost.
Right.
And then also, Doug, you're thinking too about somebody who, even if it's not a situation where someone looks like the enemy that they've been, you know, up against for however many months or years in another country, but a situation where, you know, they're coming back, they've got that kind of the stress and just, I mean, stress that we cannot imagine that they're living, you know, every second of every day, but then they have the PTSD, and then what if they knew that somebody in their family or a neighbor or a child that they, or friends they were close to had been a victim of a predator, a sexual predator? I would imagine that they would be kind of like the guards or whatever is in the, you know, a normal person should have the amygdala that is like a little pass-through, a little gateway to stop you from behaving in a certain way. You know, would it be...
Oh, yeah, like generally that, but, you know, the military people are trained to kill, and you know, so that's not something that is necessarily easily turned on and off. And then with PTSD, that makes the turning off of the warrior brain, you know, more difficult. So it's like you have the warrior brain where you're trained to kill, then you're deployed to another combat zone, and then you, through combat experience, you develop this kind of warrior brain, which is more of a, you know, falling instincts, and but also more on edge and more fearful and more likely.
No, you're also, you know, they're trained, Doug, I mean, to, you know, to protect each other. And so, you know, when they come back, they feel guilty about not being, you know, back with their friends. And, you know, it's funny. I mean, I kind of felt that way when I came back from Iraq with this unit. And, you know, I wanted to go back. I mean, I was good at that. my fantasies, you know, being a war correspondent, they came true. And then suddenly, my wife one night, CNN announced, you know, that Art's with this Marine unit, and we haven't heard from them in a day. We hope they're okay. Well, she heard that and went, you know, ballistic and called CNN. And finally, you know, I was fine. But, you know, she would hear the noise when I would call, and what's that? Oh, it's a truck backfiring. Well, you know, I didn't want to put her through that again. So, anyway, if I can, you know, help veterans, I'm all about that, and I've written a lot about the military over the years, and the military mind. And my father was on the War Production Board in World War II, and my stepfather was General Patton's aide, and I was a Navy officer, and years ago, so you know, it's sort of in my late stepfather, the another one was a Marine dive bomber pilot in the Pacific in World War II. So you know, you know this stuff gets kind of passed on, and if you can't help each other, you don't really don't have a mission. So you're back here, and without feeling any passion for what you're doing, or any you don't have a goal, and you don't have people who depend on you to live like on the battlefield. So it's a really tough transition, and I don't know. They've got it's called the TRP program. Is it trauma response? I'm trying to remember what it is where they let people go through about 8 weeks or 10 weeks of kind of deprogramming, where you write about your experiences and you talk about it, and you try to somehow take the edge off of it so that you can function better and feel better about yourself, because I think it's tough to do by yourself.
Yeah, well, there's just various programs within the VA, but one of the things that we, this program that we did, that we, our pilot program, was that we particularly focused on suicide, and we decided that the core of suicide is when people lose hope, and that the way that they lose hope is that when they become disconnected from their family. So when they come back, from Iraq and because of all the warrior brain and the symptoms they're having, they disconnect from their family, and then things start going bad, or maybe there's like infidelity or whatever. They despair, and then it became hopeless, and then suicide ensues. So we decided that the way to prevent that is to really focus on the family connection, and so that's why we did this program where we would bring the entire family together, including the kids, and put them in one place for 10 days time, which is the ideal situation, but it's probably not economically viable. But we could probably do lesser forms, and then just focus right there on helping reintegrate with the family, and part of that is teaching people, well, why is it that, your soldier husband is having trouble connecting? Well, because he has this military mind that is having trouble transitioning from behaviors that were adaptive in Iraq, which is like being vigilant and always, on guard. And, maybe that's not so adaptive when you come back. But it's not like a light switch you can just turn on and off. You can't just say, okay, you're back, turn the light switch off, go back to working at Walmart. It doesn't work that way,
Sadly, victims are often the wives and the children too. I mean, I don't know if you studied any of that, or if Susie, you ever have written
about it. Well, there have been studies that showing that we haven't done it, but there have been studies showing that, in family, military families where one of the parents has PTSD, the child performance is worse, the marital satisfaction is worse. Pretty much every outcome that you look at, it affects the entire family. And not only does that impact like the soldier and the military, but the fact is that these families are military families, like you said yourself, that there's generations of people in the military. So, by kind of messing up the family or creating more divorces or whatever, it's really impairing the long-term combat effectiveness of our professional armed services, is basically what we have.
And if I could just get in here a second. I'm sorry, guys. If you have just a second, Doug, I also want to make sure, while you're still with us, that anyone listening who wants to know about your book, you can't just snap out of it, about PTSD or any of your other books or your films. Your website is DougBremner.com. That's DougBremner.com. And if you go there, it's fascinating all the things that you do and you create, Doug. And I'm really grateful that... that you've come back on the show to share with us.
And I'm delighted
to meet
you.
Thanks for having me, Jennifer.
I hope we can talk again.
So, Doug, can you stay just a few more minutes with me?
Sure.
Just a few? All right, good. So I want to go to Susie Parker. Susie?
Yes, I'm here.
Because your first book, when we started the show, we were talking about the because pedophilia... And your first book is called Sex in the South, Unbuckling the Bible Belt.
That's correct.
And so I get the feeling that, you know, you might see there's a lot of some of the South's attitudes or repression about sex. God knows, Art and I had a fascinating talk about this afternoon, too, but how this might affect people's behavior or denial of their behavior or their own personal demons.
Yeah, I mean, I don't. In my book, I don't talk about pedophiles per se. Mine's more of a it's a funny look at it's humorous of people's fetishes throughout the South. And but that being said, I do look a lot at the repression and the Bible Belt and the theme of religion, because I believe that in the South. And this is true all over. But in the South, you know, it is called the Bible Belt because we have a church on every corner. And especially in small towns, you know, sometimes you have, you know, four churches on four corners facing each other. I do believe that this theme of this, the you know, God and religion and Bible thumping does present, does make things go underground. And that, sadly, also includes child abuse. And I think that it does create a culture of denial. Yeah.
And here's what I want to ask you about too. And you know, and anybody else wants to weigh on this too, after Sir Susie, is that someone today had seen what I had been writing and posting about the show, and said to me, "Well, you know, everybody's attacking Josh Duggar because he's a public figure. However, think about it, the kind of sexual repression or what he may have been taught growing up. Nobody talks to us, you know, some of us kids about, you know, what's going to happen, what your urges are, what they mean, what to do, how to handle, how to control them. So then
exactly.
When he does something, it's like, oh, my God. So then they do, I guess, what, you know, a lot of parents do and try to hide and cover up. Of course, I'm, you know, interested about what about the girls, too. But so do you think that is an effect? Is that what you say? That, you know,
well,
they don't
again,
know?
I didn't hear that question.
Well,
when
somebody has not really been taught about sex.
Oh, definitely.
And what's
going
to happen and what to expect when puberty comes and their hormones are crazy and they don't know what all this is and their body's nuts and they're nuts and their impulses and urges and what to do, how to handle, how to control it.
Yes. I mean, even in the 21st century, I mean, with so much media, I mean, we still have these, you know, huge pockets, I believe, in the South of where, you know, sex is just, you know, is a sin, and it's preached that, you know, it's preached sometimes every Sunday, every Wednesday night in churches across the South, and then you've got, like, the Duggars part of this Quiverful movement, which is its own strange religious, some people say cult, where everything is off limits. I mean, everything. It's, you know, you can't even hold hands on a date. So I would have to say that breeds some sort of, I mean, curiosity. I mean, human nature is curious, and, you know, boys and girls and what have you. Yeah, when you hit puberty, you're, of course, like, what's going on? I mean, you know, it's kind of like nature.
So have you been to a lot of the services where the fever pitch happens, you know.
Yes,
and
I have.
That spirit gets moving and riled up. And I think from covering the South and covering all the TV preacher scandals from Jimmy Swaggart
mm-hmm.
to Jim and Tammy and Jessica Hahn and all that, which revolved around using sex, I call
mm-hmm.
them godfathers of the gospel. They use
uh-huh.
sex and innuendo to bump each other off instead of bullets. And
right.
so here you've got this, you know, they're up there preaching and screaming and jumping and shouting, and it
mm-hmm.
gets people, it gets you jazzed up. And so
right.
I think that the quote spirit is mixed in with the sexuality that's aroused often. And what do you do with that? Well,
right.
Jimmy,
I agree.
You know, we know what Jimmy Swaggart did, and, you know, I'm the one who found his Lady of the Night on Airline Highway and actually interviewed her on CNN
right.
Years later and asked, so Jimmy Swaggart says he's never kissed a woman other than his wife. Is he telling the truth? Long pause, looks at the ceiling. Well, I don't believe he ever kissed me.
No.
So, But, you know, so there may not be a lot of romance. But I then went to the campus bookstore, and he had written these little pamphlets, you know, about the demons of different kind of sexual aberrations. And in reading it, it felt like he was writing and raging at himself for the guilt he felt because he couldn't control it. And,
right, it's almost like it's a split personality thing going on sometimes with these people. Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so, you know, what happened was he winds up with Deborah Murphy on Airline Highway, and a preacher named Marvin Gorman, who Swaggart had bumped off by ratting him out for his, quote, infidelities, and he lost a huge TV deal. Suddenly he finds out that Swaggart's going there, and he gets a private eye. He's taking pictures of that room. And so here's Swaggart comes out and goes to his Lincoln Town car and bends down in his jogging suit with the slit in the pants and the red bandana on. And Marvin Gorman goes up and says, "So Jimmy, what are you doing here?" He says, "Marvin, I'm just changing my tire. What are you doing here?" He says, "Jimmy, it's bad enough that you're lying about it now, but you don't have a flat tire. My private eye cut your valve stem." So suddenly he had to sit down and talk to Gorman, and later interviewed Marvin, and I got all the pictures, and can't say how I got them, but anyway, they told this story on CNN, and it was that Swaggart confessed to Gorman, and later denied it, of course, that he had done this for 26 years in every city he had preached at, and that he was really, really worried about the women he'd been with, because if they went to hell, he would feel really guilty. He didn't know what to do. So,
right.
He didn't think he'd go to hell?
You see, so yeah, at least he had some concerns for them. But it is so twisted up.
It is twisted. It's hard. It's like a double helix. Because so many people like Jimmy Swaggart, and you know, we've seen politicians and we've seen ministers and now the Duggars, and you know, they think that they also feel like you're saying, like he felt, you know, felt bad for the women maybe going to hell. I think you also have people. Not necessarily. I mean, they hide behind the Bible, but they also think that if they pray it out or confess their sins, that somehow it will make everything better. You know, like it clears it, and as opposed to maybe getting help, getting therapy, talking it out, getting counseling.
Yeah.
You know, they think praying
and then do you find that often they blame the woman? Right out of the Bible, you have Adam and Eve, and so she's the temptress, and that's the fallback, which is so unfair.
And that is exactly what's happening with the Duggars. They have this whole theory that it's the woman to blame.
Yeah.
So his sisters are to blame.
What was that?
His sisters, younger,
right? Yes.
Are to blame.
I read something
lovely
yesterday where they have a code, the Duggar family, and they have a code that if they see a woman walking down the street that they believe is immodestly dressed, which is probably anything that we would all wear, like a tank top and a skirt or whatever that's not down to your ankles, they have a code word, Nike, that they say to the children so that the children look down at the feet and not at, any other part of the woman's body.
You've got to be kidding.
No. That was in the Washington Post yesterday.
Okay. I believe it, but it just...
Yeah. And it's written in one of the, of Michelle Duggar's books, and the Washington Post quoted it yesterday, which is amazing. I mean, I didn't even know that till yesterday.
Yeah.
All right,
know,
guys,
yeah,
I've got one announcement I need to make, and if you don't mind. Okay, again, thank you for listening. If you're new, if you just tuned in, this is Madam Perry Salon. I'm your cruise director, Jennifer Perry. My guests tonight, Art Harris, Susie Parker, Cheryl or S.J. Dunn, and a special extra guest, Doug Bremner. Now, are any writers out there listening? Do you want to pitch your book to an agent, meet a traditional publisher? Do you want to find out what bookstores are looking for and get some help marketing your book? Well, you need to register for Publish 15. Publish 15 takes place June 13th and 14th at the Forsyth Conference Center in Cumming, Georgia. It'll have workshops, literary agent pitching, a publishing expo, book printing demos, and prizes. And you can meet experts from St. Martin's Press, Create Space, Balker, the U.S. Review of Books and More, and published 15. Now, this is put on by BookLogix, which is BookLogix. Published 15 is open to the public. Tickets are available at the door, or you can register early at publish15.com. And if you want, because you're listening to the show right now, you can save 50% off of Publish 15 registration when you register online at publish15.com using code WRITER15 for being on the show. Okay, so thank you so much to Angela at BookLogix for letting us know that and for giving us a discount if you're listening. Now, I have a question from our friend David Hurley. David Hurley is a writer, poet, and publisher of Subtlety Magazine, and he always texts in his questions. So if you guys, I want you to all listen so that everybody, you can all give me your own or give David your own answer on this. And he says, my question, I think, oh, and by the way, David's recent book is Sharon Tate and the Daughters of Joy. Highly recommend that. So he says, my question is, I think the best way to describe the fallout of child abuse, particularly of the sexual kind, is anguish. I can't imagine the anguish of being a parent of a victim. It's the worst crime on earth. The 2013 film Prisoner certainly portrays this and shows how easy and understandable it is to slip into vigilantism when the law seems ineffective or too slow. Then there's anguish of another kind, I think. It seems that some pedophiles are under a sick compulsion and maybe even hate themselves for their desires and crimes if acted out. And he continues, back in 1931, Fritz Lang showed a hopeless sickness in a character played by Peter Lorre. Criminals team up and decide to lynch the child abuser themselves, and before they pass sentence on him, he gives quite a desperate speech, including these telling lines. If there's all the time, it's there all the time, driving me out to wander the streets, following me silently, but I can feel it there. It's me, pursuing myself. I want to escape from myself, but it's impossible. I can't escape it. I have to obey it. And he says, how do any of you on the panel, or any of my guests tonight, how do any of you react to this side of the horror? We tend to want overwhelming punishment and even revenge. I know my outrage is astronomical, but the other kind of anguish complicates things, doesn't it? He says that movie was called M. Okay, thank you, David Hurley. Anyone?
It's a rich question.
Yes.
I mean, I guess what he's saying, it sounds to me, is that these predators, they have a compulsion that's uncontrollable that they wrestle with and they hate themselves for, and but they keep doing it, and I think that if that's the case with some of them, that is perhaps not admirable, but at least maybe there's a window for treatment. But from the experts, the psychologists I talked to, is it Gene Abel here at Emory, that's done all sorts of work on pedophiles. They can't be cured, and it's a compulsion they can't control. I don't know if that is the case or not. Whether you count drugs, but if you can't control it, then how do you count on somebody to stop it inside a family, or even outside? So, but the anguish, it could also be the anguish of a victim. I can tell you, Wayne mm-hmm. Williams, the serial killer in Atlanta. I don't think he killed all 29 of the victims. That were laid on him. But I covered that trial for the Washington Post, and he would go out and pass out these flyers as a rock and roll promoter, that he was looking for talent, and they mm-hmm. were young kids, street kids, mm-hmm. and some of them were, he thought they were street hustlers, and there was part of Wayne, I think, that had all this self-loathing, that he felt perhaps he had these desires, and he was going to snuff out the evil in the community by killing these kids. When in fact he was killing part of himself.
Well, the expert that advised me on my work, Dr. Shabraham Lerazzi, he's a forensic psychiatrist who treats pedophiles and also is recognized at a court as court witness, etc. He said that they go through this, the majority of pedophiles go through this cycle of, we'll start with the remorse phase. They've committed some kind of pedophilic act, and they go through this terrible, terrible remorse and anguish. And if they're treated at that point, there's some hope that they won't repeat the cycle. But the next part of the cycle is that a lot of them don't have very good social skills or life coping skills. And so they run into some kind of problem in their life, at work, at home or whatever. They're having difficulty handling it. They don't know how to handle it. And so they start fantasizing. And then eventually the fantasy becomes a compulsion, and they have to act out again. But the interesting thing is that Dr. Lerazzi told me that for every pedophile who acts on his compulsions, there are at least two men who are pedophiles but never act on their compulsions.
Wow, that's amazing.
So if that's true, and I suspect it is, then obviously some pedophiles can control their compulsion.
And
so the thing is to try and find out how to treat these people so that they can control their compulsions, because it is terribly anguishing for them.
I'm sorry,
I see Doug Bremner is back in. And by the way, Doug, I didn't tell you this, but you look great tonight. You look great.
We have another
call. Thank you for dressing up for me. And we have another caller that called in that I haven't been able to greet yet, from a 434 area code. Hi, this is Madam Perry, and you are?
Hello, Madam Perry. It's Bunny Goodjohn on the line.
Bunny Goodjohn. Yes, Bunny Goodjohn. Who lives in Lynchburg, Virginia, and teaches at Randolph College, and she's actually from London. And she has a new book out, a new book of poetry called Bone Song. So everyone, please welcome Bunny.
Hey, Bunny.
Bunny, I heard your interview with Diana Bell-Rose, and I generally don't listen to interviews for more than about 5 minutes, and I listened to the whole thing in your case. I thought it was a wonderful interview.
Oh, thank you so much. It's been really interesting with the interviews. The reason that I'm calling in is because David's question from Subtlety.
Yes.
Yeah, it was really quite kind of strange. The work that I write comes from a place in my own life of battling with addictions. And mine, I'm going to use a present tense because I don't think we ever really recover from addictions. Mine is alcohol and drug abuse. And I'm really interested in this idea of the process that you were outlining, whereby a pedophile will be seized with a craving to abuse, and that if I think somebody said that if there was an intervention at that point, then there was a fair chance of recovery. I'm just really drawn by all the parallels that I'm hearing to the whole idea of addiction, you know, whether it's to alcohol or prescription drugs or sex with minors or whatever it is, because of this process of the craving and the remorse, and then the I'm never ever going to do this again, and then the craving sets in again, and I guess my question is, I've been clean and sober for 10 years now. I will always be an alcoholic. I'm in remission. That's how I like to think of it. And I wonder whether you feel that some kind of 12-step program, is it all effective in the treatment, rehabilitation, or the, I don't even know whether it's the treatment, but the putting on hold of a pedophile's.
This sounds like Doug and Art here.
Well, I think it's fascinating. Bunny, I applaud you. you know, the fact that you're talking about something that's shared by so many people and is so personal to you, you know, it takes a lot of guts. And I think that, you know, if you compare what you're saying about with a 12-step program, I often say you've got to hit rock bottom before you're willing to make a change in your life. And for pedophiles, I would think, they're so secretive, their rock bottom is either in private or in prison. And if it's in prison, you know, it's a little late. I mean, their nickname, I think, I don't know if they still call them Short Eyes, but they're the most despised creatures in the prison, even at that level. So, but it is fascinating. Could you deliver at the moment of remorse, if you got to them, you know, a ray of hope, you know, if they could have a spiritual experience, would that overcome their compulsion? I don't know.
Well, there are statistics available about programs that treat pedophiles, and the pedophiles who do receive treatment are far less likely to commit again, far less than those who go untreated. But there's no 100% solution.
Right.
Yeah, and as a result, you know, I've talked to a lot of probation officers who are in charge of these guys when they're on probation, and they all give them polygraphs, and they're very, very skilled at picking up, you know, lies. Many of them are sociopaths who don't feel, you know, that compassion for a victim, and so they're just, you know, getting their, you know, their cravings satisfied. So how do you deal with something like that? And then if they're sociopaths, they're lying a lot to themselves and to whoever has asked them about any remission. How do you deal with that? But I know these guys are they don't believe they're truthful, and they say they got to watch them like hawks, and they give them frequent polygraphs, and if they don't pass, then you know they violated probation.
Right.
Well, when you think about the sex drive as being a drive in all of us, okay, I look at the pedophiles as having to deal with a terrible situation, because the sex drive, until we get perhaps to my age, is very strong, and so if you're oriented towards a child, how do you control that? I mean, the sex drive is huge. Some people are predisposed to be alcoholics, but all of us are predisposed to want sex pretty well.
And you know, there are multi addictions as well, so it's not as simple as that true, Bunny? Do you think that's true as well?
I really do. I mean, I've been, as I said, clean and sober now since 2005. However, once I got that particular desire under control, I was amazed at how many others were just breaking down the door. So it made me think, I mean, from silly things like, I'll give you one, for example, which sounds silly, but I think that it's telling. I developed a liking for ice cream, and I never was a great ice cream eater, but I would, in my early sobriety, I would maybe eat it twice a week, and then I'd start to eat it four times a week, and then I was just having some every day, and then it got to the point where if I did not have 2 1-liter tubs in the freezer, I would begin to panic. And that was real panic. I mean, it was, oh, my God, it's 11 o'clock at night. I need to get out. Is Kroger still open? Can I get some more ice cream? And it was the first thing that I realized that this would be a lifelong struggle with my cravings, with my urges. And I think that I have worked out that, for me, the urge is instant gratification, an instant movement from where I am emotionally and physically and spiritually to what I perceive to be a better place. And once that craving hits, you know, whether it's a Southern Comfort or Haagen-Dazs, I am in many ways powerless to put any brakes on that once the craving has actually hit. So for me, living sober, sobriety means revisiting my entire life to kind of redirect it. And so I wonder, you made this really good point about pedophilia being such a secretive addiction. And yet I wonder with women, it used to be that there weren't very many women in Alcoholics Anonymous. Now there are many, many more. I don't think it's because more women are becoming alcoholics. I think it's just that it's less shameful now. And I wonder, I mean, I don't see pedophilia ever losing its shame factor. But I wonder whether things like Sex Anonymous is home perhaps to pedophiles who are just, you know, desperate to get somewhere where they can actually get some assistance.
It's interesting that you talk about the addiction. I have friends who are in AA who talk about the same, like what you mentioned with the ice cream. They're now they're now addicted, or they have this craving for meetings, for AA meetings.
Yeah.
They're actually addicted to the AA meetings. They have to, not just one a day, or I mean, they're literally, that's their new addiction. And I mean, they will tell me that's my new addiction. And so it's very it's a very curious. It's like a craving. It's like they have to get a hit of whatever their new, whether it's ice cream or a meeting or.
Right.
Yeah. I think it's a personality trait.
I mean, I think I describe it almost as adrenaline junkies, and I have to say, I am. Maybe that's why, you know, I was drawn to journalism, because it's a deadline. It's every day you turn it in, and boom, you know, you're high, and then you crash. I mean, then you got to do it again. It's really
that's my thing.
You know, for years, you know, how do you break that cycle? Because it's pretty unhealthy, and you know. But you know, if you're, you know, you develop a writing craft, it's a writing from fear as well as you know, from the desire to create something. So you can't miss a deadline. So I don't know, but that is, I think, in all of us, how we channel that is the challenge.
Right, channel it productively or go to the dark side. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Some dark side. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, for me, that's why, you know, I love covering a war, because it, you know, there is no more you know, exhilaration than getting shot at and missed. But at the same time, people would ask me, well, you know, gee, were you afraid? Well, gosh, of course. And a general once told me, if you're not afraid, you're either lying or psychotic. So you know, it comes, you know, there are ups and there are downs with every emotion you subject yourself to. And how do you stay in that serene meditative middle? You know, let me know if you find the secret.
just an outside question here, Art. When you were embedded, it was more like that. Now, you did serve in the military, didn't you?
I did, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah,
but for a journalist that hasn't, do you have to have any other kind of special training? Any kind of military, you know, physical training or emotional before a journalist can become embedded with a unit?
Well, I know that, I mean, CNN put everybody through what they call embed training, where you actually, you know, went through everything from first aid training, what to happen, car wrecks, or one-third of the battle of the war injuries are from car wrecks, you know, in Iraq. And so, you know, what do you do if somebody is immobilized or you know, has a broken neck or something. So we learned, you know, that. We learned how to walk through a minefield. You know, you don't walk close to the person in front of you. You walk in the same, you know, steps that they walked in, and, you know, you stay about, you know, 10 yards apart. So these are things that you don't forget. And as far as chemical, you know, training, you know, how long do you have outside a gas mask if nerve gas, you know, hits. I mean, I was sleeping my first night on the ground in the desert, beautiful starry night. All of a sudden, I'm sleeping outside this truck in a sleeping bag, and I feel these droplets, and my gas mask is at the foot of my sleeping bag, and I'm thinking, oh my gosh, I know I've got 9 seconds, so do I just take a deep breath and get it over with now, or do I go for it and become, you know, raving madman? So I went for the mask, and then I hear my driver say, so, Mr. Harris, you going to stay out there in the rain, or do you want to come into the truck? So it rains differently in the desert. They're not like Georgia, rainy, you know, rainy night in Georgia. These are like big cotton ball type droplets that float down and make you think that they're nerve gas. Anyway, it was embarrassing, but I was very grateful.
Okay, all right.
So you get special training.
So Andy, but you would be special.
But it really helped me.
It helped you
to be in the military. It really helped, and I think it got me some access and some respect from these guys, because at least they thought I'd done what they had done, and I did.
I would think that would make a big difference with them, and how they listened to you and trusted you and knew that you really listened to them and understood them. I said, because I've told Cheryl Dunn here, last August I began working out at a CrossFit gym at 6 days a week at 6 or 5:30 in the morning. And so if you're ever around Avondale Estates and you go down East College Avenue and see a bunch of us at 5:35, my husband would say, "What are you doing now in your cult?" And I said, "Well, today we had to lunge from the sweat box all the way down to the, I think it's called the Corner Tavern on East College Avenue, with not walking, but lunging and holding a 30-pound plate, you know, weight over our heads. And
boy,
so while
you
we
are
did it,
Superwoman, that's fantastic.
So, and my husband, oh, thank you. My husband says, "So what are you doing? Are you training to carry your rifle over your head when you go to war? Are you sure you're not being trained for? Do you know what you're doing there? Why they're doing this?" You know, I said, "Well, you know, they." I guess I can hold my gun up that long, honey. I just don't know. So, yeah. And then I thought,
well,
that's military training. So, go ahead.
Doug Bremner's book talks about the value of exercise in dealing with past traumas, and also how important diet is, too. So, you know, maybe, Jennifer, you're dealing with a past trauma that you haven't told us about.
A past trauma? You know, good point, Cheryl.
There's one thing I can say is
that,
have you ever heard the expression, "The only normal people are those you don't know very well"?
That's it.
That's true. Doug, I'll call your office and get an appointment.
Well, and that's the whole thing, right? I mean, I think we're all repressing something. That's kind of what my book is about, Sex in the South, that, you know, some people are out with their fetishes or whatever, but I met a lot of people in the South who were into, and this was before 50 Shades of Grey, who were into the BDSM culture, and they kept it very, very secret because they were afraid of the fallout. I don't know if that's the case now after 50 Shades of Grey and everybody's talking about it, but I guess we're all dealing with some sort of dark side.
And that's what makes it interesting.
That's right. That's what gives us stuff to write about.
Right. Exactly.
Although I'm really curious about the Duggar family, only because it was within that family. You know, it wasn't an outside force coming in. It was actually within that family, and then they went on. They're a unique case, I believe, because then they, knowing the secret lurked in there, and I guess we all have secrets in our families, but that secret lurked in their family, and then they decide to go on reality TV, which you become a celebrity, it opens up, you know, your entire life to scrutiny.
Yeah.
Right.
All right, well, folks.
And being a target of someone leaking something about you.
I want to say, first of all, I am so grateful to each and every one of you for giving me so much time here, sharing with me and with the audience and with each other. And just thank you all so much. And we've got about 6 minutes left, so if we can go around one at a time, and Bunny, stay in here, and just give a minute to the audience as to what you've got coming up next and what to look for. And we'll start with Susie Parker.
Well, I have a new novel out called Echo Ellis, Adventures of a Girl Reporter. It's the first in a series, I hope. And it's a political thriller that takes place in Arkansas and Mississippi. It may or may not be based on my life. And lots of journalism. I write for The Broadside, The Daily Beast, and I cover a lot of Hillary Clinton and Mike Huckabee.
All right, fantastic. Thank you so much, Susie Parker.
And you can find me online on Twitter and Facebook and all over.
S-U-Z-I, like the model. She was S-U-Z-Y. Okay, Susie Parker,
with
S-U-Z-I. Like Susie Quattro. All right,
that's right,
Cheryl
just
Dunn.
Like Susie Quattro.
Oh, this is Cheryl, and I write I write under S.J. Dunn, and my first novel in a series about a conspiracy of women who kill pedophiles is out and available on Amazon. It's called Angry Enough to Kill, and it recently won Best Thriller in the Book Buzz Prize Writers Competition and a finalist medal in the Indie Book Awards, which are said to be the Sundance of the book publishing world. And I'm currently writing the next in the series, which is called A Million Closed Eyes. And the theme in that one is predominantly why people close their eyes to child abuse for the various reasons they close their eyes, and which I think we touched on in this thing. Anyway, I encourage people to take a look at the book, Angry Enough to Kill. And thanks so much, Jennifer, for inviting me to be with these illustrious guests.
You're all a good, cool group. You see how high I am now. Buddy Goodjohn. Buddy Goodjohn, talk to me.
Thanks, Jennifer. So I have the poetry collection that is out at the moment. It's available on Amazon, but it's also available via my website, which is B.A. Goodjohn. But you can Google Bunny Goodjohn and you'll get to me. I think there's only one Bunny Goodjohn out there, so I'm pretty lucky that way. I got a new novel coming out in November called The Beginning Things, and I have a novel already out there called Sticklebacks and Snow Globes that is available via Amazon and my website. Oh, and I've got a launch party on June 18th down here in Lynchburg at the local YWCA.
June 18th, Lynchburg, YWCA. And yes, I am Bunny's publicist, so everybody please share the word. She's a fabulous writer.
Thanks.
Doug Bremner.
Yeah, I'm here. We had that book we just talked about, You Can't Just Snap Out of It. And
you got a new film?
And the new film is based on the book, The Goose of the Golden Egg. It's written about my experience, just based on my experience as an expert witness for drug safety litigation. And we're trying to get actors for that now. It's kind of a fictionalized version of the same thing. So if anyone wants to invest $10,000, just send me an email.
I was talking to Art about that today. Mr.
Good for you, Doug.
Art,
Art Harris. I've been trying to, I've gotten several documentary projects going, and one about a young woman who's amazingly talented and at a genius level, who was paralyzed in a Team Van rollover at 16, and she won a $10 million settlement against the school system of New York, and went on to Harvard with a scholarship. She's now at Oxford. And I think her story is so inspiring. She's now starting a blog about what are the best places for handicapped people in wheelchairs, which I'd never heard anybody doing before, so I'm encouraging her. And I think, you know, that if I can get things going, I'll pursue that. At the same time, totally whipsawed a different perspective. With my wife, have created something called Blend Smart, which is the world's first spinning makeup brush, and a consumer product, patent pending, and it was sold on QVC this week for the first time, and did really well. So it blends makeup evenly and flawlessly. So I can tell you all about beauty now. If
all
any
right,
of you are interested.
Fantastic! I want her to come on the show too sometime.
It's amazing.
I need
that. She's great. But it's great. Blendsmart.com. So, but otherwise, I just can't tell you how much I've enjoyed being with all of you, and you know, all of your work is really outstanding. So I look forward to getting to know everybody better.
Good. Thank you so much. You know, you and I followed you for so many years, Art, and you and I first met at the Turner Studios on 17th Street, I believe, where it was one of the very first tapings of Nancy Grace Swift Justice.
Yep,
and
it was over
you were
at GPTV.
Yeah, GPTV. You were just so kind of so helpful to me. All right, we got 60 seconds. Oh, I'm sorry. 60 seconds. Thank you so much, Art Harris, Doug Bremner, Susie Parker, S.J. Cheryl Dunn, Bunny Goodjohn, and also to our previous questions and callers, Carrie Dunn, David Hurley of Subtlety Magazine,
Book Logics. Thank you so much. And thank you to my wonderful husband, who made my intro music, Miss E's Vacation. And this is Madame Perry Salon. I hope I see you all again very soon. And support these writers. Check them out. I've got the links to their websites on everything I have. And everyone, as you can tell, I don't know which one of you has got a woodshop class going on back there in the background, but I'd love to know what you're making. Anyways, Madame Perry Salon, thank you all so very much.
Checking Georgia Oysters here.
Thank you, Jennifer.
And you
can,
thank you. It is downloadable on iTunes.
Thanks so much.
No charge. Thank you very much.